And hello out there to all of you Brooklyn folk and beyond. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And today is a very special day. Unfortunately, baseball in the tri-state area got rained out. It is certainly drowned out around here right now. But have no fear, we are here for the Jackie Robinson Day festivities, and without further ado, let's welcome our mini panel, if you will, to talk about both Jackie Robinson as well as specifics regarding the day he broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. So without further ado, let's bring on our folks. We got out in Kansas City, the Negro League, the official Negro League historian, I believe, Mr. Phil Dixon, is that appropriate to say that you really are the way John Thorne has been crowned for, you know, Major League Baseball? Would you say that you are the pinnacle of Negro League history within the field, excuse me?
Well, I'd like to say that I do my very best. I've been at it a while, and I've paid my dues. So, you know, if people like my information, they can call me what they want to. But when you want good history, I just want you to know my number's available.
I like the way you phrase it. So thank you for joining us today to talk Jackie Robinson. And out in Brooklyn, holding down the fort in all this rain, the Brooklyn Trolley blogger himself, Mike LeColant. What is going on, Mike?
Hello.
You're a little bit of a Negro League historian yourself.
I'm just passionate about baseball and anybody who played it. And if you played it here in Brooklyn, you know, I'm all over it. But thank you, Sam. Thank you very kindly for that introduction. And hello, Phil. Great speaking with you
hey
again,
there.
Sir.
That's my pleasure.
So let's get right into it. I hope you're all somewhere warm and dry and not caught up in the rain. But Phil, I think that's actually a good place to go. It wasn't raining on 4/15/1947, but by all indications, it was a similar sky, very overcast that day, a little bit of a chill on the air. If you could start wherever you would like regarding 4/15/1947 at Ebbets Field.
Well, I tell you what, it was a historic day then when the Brooklyn took the field against the Boston Braves. Historic day then, and had about 25,000 people who watched history. That's not a lot of people, but that was a good crowd, and that was early in the season. And, you know, early in the season, you know, I played high school baseball, and on April 15th, you know, you could get 70-degree weather or you might get 30-degree weather. So just one of those kind of things. But a very historic day and just really good to go back and visit that period all over again.
You know, it's interesting the way you say it, 25,000. You know, the capacity of the ballpark was only about 35,000, but they would fit 38 occasionally. Was there a buzz in the air? What was going on within the crowd regarding the moment?
Well, you know, and of course, you know, I wish I could have been there. Of course, I wasn't there. But, you know, I think most people knew that it was going to be Jackie Robinson's debut. And when I researched newspapers, they would say Jackie Robinson, first Negro ever to reach the majors. So people were watching this event all over, and that was kind of like the little subtitle or one of the things that were mentioned in the article from that game that day. People knew that this was a game to watch because it was something, you know, going to be unique. And one of the first modern-day black ball players, and for some people, they were saying the first because most of them didn't get the history about Fleetwood Walker. So that history wasn't even known to most people. And the big leagues, they basically pushed their own agenda and called Jackie Robinson the first. And so many things you can say about that day, the people who were in there and some of the history of some of those guys that were actually there that day. and even some of Jackie Robinson's own teammates as well. So just interesting. It's probably been talked about quite a bit too over the years, and people talk about it, but it's always great to go back and revisit that day.
So if we could go real quick into who the first black player in Major League Baseball, since like you said, it was really Jackie Robinson was really the first in a modern sense, just because of basically, you know, as we've always talked about, the gentleman's agreement, the unofficial gentleman's agreement.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting when you say modern, because really writers of baseball history don't always separate the game from modern to, pre-modern. And I'll give you an example. I was reading some articles here recently about ballplayers who had five hits on opening day. And, they mentioned different people. I think they mentioned one of the guys with the Washington Senators. I wish I would have kept the article. I had it around for a few days. But they went all the way back to 1894 talking about ballplayers who had five hits on opening day. So when you talk about Jackie Robinson, it's interesting that, you know, you would use the word modern when baseball history doesn't separate them at all, even though we know that there's a difference in the way the game was played in 1894 versus 2021. They're still not separating it.
So before I go to Mike in terms of kind of the modern Brooklyn feel, if you will, paint the picture for us. Where was Jackie starting, and how did he do? How did the day go?
Yeah, Jackie Robinson. Who you want to talk?
Sorry, Phil. Go ahead, please. Before we go to Mike.
Yeah, Jackie Robinson started at first base, which is kind of interesting because he came out of the Negro Leagues as a shortstop. And at the Kansas City Monarchs, he had been a shortstop. And so by the time he makes his Major League debut, he's a first baseman. And, of course, that first game he went 0-3, by the way, had 11 putouts, but did not make an error. As far as I know, did not make an error that day. So, maybe – someone else can comment a little further on that.
Well,
I believe, Mike, I'm not sure. Sorry,
go ahead,
I was
Sam.
Just going to ask. Did he walk and score a run, if I remember correctly?
He scored a run that day. He went 0-3 officially at the plate. He got caught up in a double play, a fine play in the field. So, you know, you can't begrudge him for that. But he did go hitless. But there was a lot of electricity in the air, you know. So baseball, we know, is a game of averages. So, you know, you can't hold this singular game against him. But the electricity was undeniable. And he did score a run.
Yeah, had my memory served me correctly, and unfortunately I hadn't completely brushed up on exactly what happened that day. But, Phil, I'd like to talk about the Rachel Robinson angle of things, which I don't think it gets talked about enough, but I do remember, and again, an episode that I haven't watched in a while, but I thought that Ken Burns did a pretty solid job with some of the work, basically showing it from her angle and what the day was like for her in the stands. So if you could talk about Rachel Robinson.
Well, I haven't actually, spoken to Rachel about that specifically. Now, I can talk in general because one thing Jackie Robinson faced, and he had many people who would come out to the game who did not want him to be there. But Jackie Robinson always had a lot of fans who were there who wanted him to be there. And I think most of the times we talk about Jackie Robinson, I don't think enough is said about the people who wanted him to be there in those initial days of that first season and the support he had in trying to execute this. Yeah, he ran against some opposition, players on the field, fans in the stands. but he had a lot of really good support that he could lean on, and that helped him make it through that most difficult period in breaking down the color barrier in Major League Baseball.
A lot of people have said, I think it since the day it happened, when they talk about the moment, a lot of people talk about how it couldn't have happened anywhere but Brooklyn. Mike, I'll start with you since you are a Brooklyn boy and you're down there currently. Do you think that is completely true with the environment of the times, only 16 teams? Could it have really truly only happened as smoothly, I guess if you're grading on a curve, as it did happening in Brooklyn?
I think there's something to that. What a lot of people fail to know and understand is Clark Griffith, 10 years prior to Jackie Robinson, considered signing Josh Gibson. But he didn't have the guts. Plain and simple, he didn't have the guts to follow through. And he also considered, losing gate receipts because he was bringing in a good chunk of change when the Grays were playing at Griffith Stadium in Washington. So there was economic conditions, but there was also apprehension that people weren't getting over yet until Branch Rickey. We know he was a maverick, and he was in all sorts of endeavors with numerous teams and numerous leagues for that matter. So perhaps it's a combination of Brooklyn and Branch Rickey, or Branch Rickey and Brooklyn. But, today I say with great admiration for my borough of Brooklyn, there is no more diverse place on planet Earth than Brooklyn. I think that's fact. And perhaps part of that held true even back then. New York City, I always say, does not belong to America. New York City is not America, and America is not New York City. So this is a different condition that people come into that really one does not face when you leave, say, the 100-mile perimeter of this city. Was starting in Brooklyn more feasible and viable as opposed to another city, another one of the 15 cities? Yeah, perhaps. I would even go beyond that and say most definitively. But it could have happened at the Polo Grounds. It could have happened at Yankee Stadium. But no, it happened in here in Brooklyn. But again, I don't think you could say Brooklyn without mentioning Branch Rickey. He was the maverick in all that. And it was his endeavors to constantly search and seek out talent for the sake of baseball and winning. But he knew what was at stake. He absolutely knew what was at stake. So there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. But, that was the condition right back then. And, Phil brought up that day in April 15th of 1947 that there was only 26,000 people there. And that's somewhat mystifying. All right, yeah, it took place on a weekday, Tuesday. And that's a weekday. Back then, people still somehow found their way to the game, unlike mm-hmm. today where we have night games and you go after work. But 26,000 was low, and that's a little bit mystifying. In fact, the Dodgers drew the least or the fewest people of any National League team opening or playing that day. That in itself is a little mystifying, not to mention that in the same city, the Yankees drew roughly 39,000 folks to their game. But at the same time, mm-hmm. you see, this is the mystifying part, because the Dodgers, throughout 1947, we know they played in one of the smallest parks in baseball, I think the second smallest park in the National League, yet they were first in attendance. So, those are two conflicting statistics right there. I'd love to know more about that particular Tuesday afternoon, April 15th of 1947, and why only 26,000 people showed up.
Interesting.
Well, it certainly, yeah, it makes me wonder if there's anything in the Brooklyn Eagle, which, of course, you and I, Mike, now finally have a little bit more access to. So maybe that's definitely an endeavor for either you or me. Phil, what were you about
to say? Well, you know what? But you know what? Brooklyn Eagle or not, as Phil says, Jackie Robinson's arrival in Brooklyn was no mystery. It was known. He played in an exhibition game in a Montreal Royals uniform against the Dodgers on April 10th. And that day, they drew 14,000 people to Ebbets Field. Again, that was an exhibition. But we also tend to forget the reason why there's a statue in Jersey City of Jackie Robinson, not necessarily one here in Brooklyn. There is one in Coney Island. But people tend to forget that because that's a minor league park, and we want to see this on a major league scale. But 25,000 people showed up in Jersey City in 1946 to see an exhibition game, including the Montreal Royals and Jackie Robinson. So he was no stranger here locally. We knew he was coming. We put that in quotes. We knew he was coming. But again, I'd have to point back to that attendance figure on April 15th of only 26,000. That's a little bit mystifying for someone they knew was coming their way, and for an event they knew was about to take place.
You know, one thing that I like to add, because I'm loving this conversation, and I talk about this in my Dizzy Dean book, how like the United Press, UP, or AP, they would put out a general article, right, about a ball game. And then when they went out to the newspapers, they could title that article any way they wanted to. So over the years, I've looked at Southern newspapers and tried to see how they would title it. So I'm just going to give you one. This is Knoxville, Tennessee newspaper. When they talked about that first game, they said, Jackie Robinson finds stinking as much faster in the majors after making his debut. So if you read between the lines, you see that they're already basically discounting that a black guy can't think like a white guy because he's playing Major League Baseball, even though Negro Leagues have been beating Major League teams and made them playing Major League Baseball players for years. But they wanted to focus in on his mind, and that's not typically what they would do with white baseball players. And then I also might mention another guy, the owner of the Boston Braves, Bob Quinn, in 1938, we're going to go back a few years, he prophesied that the National League would have colored players before the rival American League. And then he added that his Braves would integrate their team before the Red Sox. Now, is that prophecy or what?
Mm. Very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and he probably certainly had an idea as to how racist they, you know, the owners were over with the Red Sox, but I guess that's certainly a digression. Phil, I'd like to ask you the same question in terms of the Brooklyn question, not being from Brooklyn, and what you know of the area and what you know of the Brooklyn Dodgers as well as Branch Rickey. Do you think it's appropriate to say that it couldn't have happened anywhere else? Although, when Mike brings up Washington, D.C., I wonder whether it was the progressive haven that it is now, back then.
Yeah, you know, I can't say that it couldn't have happened anywhere else, but you certainly needed a place where there was enough diversity in the population, right? And even though some cities like St. Louis had diversity, it took them years to get a black ball player. Cincinnati took them years. And of course, you know, we know the story on Boston. So could it have happened somewhere else? Yeah, it could have, but you needed a forward-thinking individual. And Branch Rickey, one thing that he was all about trying to control baseball through his minor league system early on. And so I think he took a look at the Negro Leagues and thought, maybe, hey, I might be able to do something here that's unique as well, which he did. It seemed like maybe it was the right place. It's hard to say looking back at it, because there were some cities with more black population, but there's no other Harlem in this whole country, you know. And outside of New York, the only other place I could think about would maybe be Chicago.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
That could happen
in
Chicago.
Ahead, Mike.
You are. No, that's right. You just exploded a light bulb over my head. This could have very easily happened in Chicago.
So with that, here's my follow-up question, and I'll start with you, Phil. Do you think it was next to impossible for Branch Rickey to do anything in St. Louis at the time?
St. Louis, a unique city. Matter of fact, St. Louis was, I think, the last team when Bush bought the team. They were the last team to stop segregated seating in their park.
Mm.
So, yeah, St. Louis actually in 1941, they were one of the last teams to actually allow black teams to play in their park as well. So St. Louis probably wouldn't have been the best place. And of course, you know, I live in Missouri. And, of course, in the Civil War, St. Louis was considered the South. So, yeah, you could take that for what it's worth. But, yeah, it was a very segregated city. And, once again, it started right at the bleachers. And the black people had the worst seat in the house because the bleachers weren't covered.
And you know, Sam,
Mike, I remember,
think this is also... Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was just going to lead before I pass it on to you that Kurt Flood, the owner, Bush, I'm totally spacing on his name, but he was unaware that Kurt Flood, I think in the early 60s, wasn't staying with the team.
Hmm.
I'm just thinking about that. I'm thinking about that. That's not triggering any memories. But what I will say, we mentioned Rachel, and we mentioned the South, and we mentioned Montreal. And I think it's and this leads into Brooklyn. I think it's important because it came from Jackie and Rachel's mouth that Montreal – was a tremendous assist in the transition from the South towards Brooklyn. They loved Montreal. They have nothing but good things to say about Montreal. And that served, playing there for a year, that served as a major, major transitioning effect in both their lives. I think without that pit stop, Jockey's debut might have been a little bit more difficult. I think because he started in Montreal and because of the reception he received there, the good reception, it may have helped his confidence as he stepped forward into this major endeavor.
Phil, let me go to you with that. You know, I think that was a deliberate reason why Branch Rickey put him in Montreal. And if you could speak to that, but also contrast the experience that Larry Doby had. Where was Larry Doby before he came to Cleveland? Where was Larry Doby in the minors before he came to Cleveland? Excuse me.
Okay, Larry never went to the minors. He went straight from the Newark Eagles directly to the big leagues. Same thing. Actually, is the second black ball player, first in the American League. But the third and fourth players, Willard Brown and Hank Thompson, never went to the minors either. See, these ball players had major league ability, so they didn't really need to go to the minors. But they were buying players so fast in the next couple of years, which was pretty much putting the Negro Leagues out of business. But they were buying ball players. They never had any intention of bringing them up to the big leagues. They bought so many ball players. And most of the big league teams had a quota that they won't talk about. But I think the New York Giants were the first team to actually have five black players, and they weren't bench players either. So if you came up, you were going to be not a bench player. You were going to be in the lineup. And so, and, you know, but I might also mention this because we talk a lot about the particular game. Well, you know, after the game, Jackie Robinson couldn't even take a shower in the same place as his teammates. I don't know if you knew that.
That's interesting to speak of. And, of course, if we were to go a little bit to the lead-up to the game, the infamous petition that was squashed by Leo DeRocher and Branch Rickey. So expand on that a little bit as it pertains to what you just mentioned.
Elaborate just a little bit more. I want to make sure I'm to answer this correctly.
Sure. No. Just in terms of, you know, with the petition in mind and where what was the environment was within the clubhouse at that time. If you could expand on the fact that he wasn't even able to take showers with his teammates.
Yeah, if people, you know, it almost sounds incredible, but all of these are things that comes out of racism, the racist history of America. I always jokingly tell people, I say, you know, America, baseball was America's national pastime, but its other national pastime was racism. And so Jackie not being able to take a shower, you know, is kind of interesting. There's a whole history in that as well. And I might also mention, pulling these articles. I just want to share a little bit more. So I'm going to throw – can I throw one more in there with you?
Yes, please.
This is one from Greensboro, North Carolina, and they're talking about Jackie Robinson giving an interview after the first game. First of all, they titled it Jackie Remains Calm After Debut in the Majors, as if, you know, black people are real excitable, that kind of thing. And then he goes on to put a quote. Jackie said, it felt good, very good. And he's talking about the first black player to reach the major leagues. And then the writer says, he said this between flashes of his piano key smile. But there were all kinds of slanted articles that came out of this first game that have seemed to be overlooked over the years, but the information is just there. And if you go to some of the southern newspapers, you will recognize some of these comments real easy. So,
and it is also not just the southern papers, Mike. You know, it's also interesting to see some of these papers up north that, you know, sometimes the racism wasn't as out in the open, if you will.
No, on the one hand, you know, we like to think as writers, as professionals, and in doing so, they're there to report. So if they're there to report the game, you're going to sound somewhat neutral. Now, if you're a feature writer, that's, you know, where the box of 64 crayons comes into play. And all their colorful descriptions. But I think you just have to look at the author. You have to look at the newspaper or the tabloid and take that into context first. If you were a beat writer, you were just talking about the game. But if you're a feature writer, you know, those are the ones who got to expand a little bit more. And, you know, by doing so, we get a little bit of insight into the greater thinking. You know, racism is still alive and well. These are the post-war years, and now everyone's coming home and they want things to go back to the way they were. Well, sorry, that's not happening. Things are about to change very quickly. You know, some people were
sounds
up to speed,
familiar,
some people
Mike.
Just weren't.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, history repeats itself insofar as this conversation. You know, but you know, some people were up to speed and some people weren't. Some people were open and adaptive, and some people were simply, you know, averse to change. And I think these people identified themselves very clearly in their work. As Phil says, researching these newspaper articles, you know, some of the descriptives, right out of a box of Crayola crayons, they're so colorful. I mean, they really go out of their way to just not outright and overtly say what they're really thinking.
Oh, my God. So here's an example, Phil, that I came across, and it was a completely inadvertent. I was looking for some other keyword, and I stumbled across the article, and it was something in the 30s from the New York Times talking about a mugging around, like, 72nd Street off of the park. And they don't mention the woman, they don't mention the race of the woman who was mugged, but they mention that it was a Negro man that mugged her. I think the New York Times was probably rather whitewashed for years. But it's even in, like, you know, little moments like that where it's not even necessarily the wording, it's just the fact that they have to specify the race of one person, but they don't specify the race of another.
Yeah. You know, newspaper reporting at that time, you know, people like to think that they were getting just straight news. But even at that time, there were Republican slanted newspapers,
right,
and Democratic slanted newspapers. I know I go and do research maybe in a small town. I know, and you might see the newspaper would be the such-and-such Republican or the such-and-such Democrat. You see those in a lot of small towns. But because of that, you know, those same things carry through with sports. So if you look at, you know, the Southern newspapers, you probably say, okay, I can see that's the South. But, yeah, there was a lot of things going on in the North as well. And then there was a lot of newspapers, like, for instance, in Boston that same day. So they played Brooklyn. There was an author named Arthur Sampson was his name. And basically his article, he subtitled in there, "Thousands Remain Away in Protest." And then he talked about the scattered groups of Negro fans through the stands. But he said that even the rabid Brooklyn fans stayed away, even knowing that this was, Jackie Robinson's debut. So he actually talks about the protests that they were protesting. But once again, that's the Boston newspaper. And of course, Boston was their opponent today, so you can take that any way. But, certainly lots of good stuff out there. And, oh, by the way, it was 6,000 customers short of a packed house, 6,000 short.
Mike, go ahead. It sounded like you were going to say something.
No, I'm just saying, you know, we like to celebrate what happens on the field, in between the foul lines, in the batter's box, and on the pitcher's mound. But after that 27th out, we still have to live life. And at some point, Jackie Robinson has to leave Ebbets Field. You know, that's a relatively, let's put this in quotes, safe place to be for 2 hours a day. But you still have to go out and live life. You brought up the issue of the showers. And those are all the changes which still need to take place. Much of life is not catching up to what Branch Rickey, the Dodgers, and Jackie Robinson are trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
There's so many different places that I want to go, but there was something that, when you mentioned the statues, Mike, I'm wondering about this. So there is a statue of Jackie Robinson in Coney Island, but it also celebrates the unity of him and the white ball player Pee Wee Reese. So I'm wondering, and I'll start here with you, Phil, please. Do you think that, like, it's celebrating the unity, but do you think there's still a little too much of the celebrating the white people that accepted it? And mind you, I'm not putting Pee Wee Reese down, or the fact that, like, we should talk about the fact that, like the story about Red Barber after hearing about it from Branch Rickey, which we can go into in a second. But, like, do you think there needs to be more celebration of the individual as opposed to the fact that, like, white people allowed it to happen?
Yeah, I think it's still a lot that needs to be told about the Jackie Robinson whole experience. You figure that so much has been written on the story, and a lot's been written about, you know, Branch Rickey and his experiment. But at the same time, I am still finding things to write about related to this day, or the things that led up to this day, that things that surrounded it. And I know, even talking to players like Joe Black over the years, he used to tell me that Jackie Robinson would have fights with his teammates under the stands, his own teammates, or players on other teams under the stands that people never knew about. And, he gave me some names of some players. So I'm not going to mention them today. I don't know if he really ever wanted it known. But, yeah, Jackie Robinson was actually having fights. So when you see him on the field, you didn't really want to mess with that guy for real. But some people wanted to challenge him away from the field. And, of course, you know, you don't hear anything about who roomed with Jackie when he went on the road. You don't hear much about he couldn't stay in the hotel. You can name specific hotels. I know here in Kansas City, there's a hotel that's still in business now. And when Elston Howard joined the Yankees as late as 1955, he couldn't stay at that particular hotel, which is in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. So they came over to my hometown, which is a lot smaller, Kansas City, Kansas, right across the river, and the Yankees came to my hometown to stay in the townhouse hotel because they couldn't get their player would not be able to stay with them in Kansas City, Missouri. Still Missouri again. So we don't talk enough about who roomed with Jackie. He's there by himself. And, there's so much you could talk about related to this experience that I think, you know, when you think that you've heard the whole story, you just really know you haven't heard the whole story.
You know, that's a great point, and that's why we have to keep having these discussions. Mike, if you'd like to expand on that.
Well, the pace of the story is deplorable. If you want to do the math, Jackie Robinson made his debut in 1947. Civil rights legislation wasn't signed till 20 years later. And it took till 1974 till Frank Robinson was the first African-American manager. So the pace needs to be brought front and center and thrown in people's faces and say, look, how long must this take? Because this is going on generations. We can talk decades within our lifetimes, Phil, Sam, and me, but this is going on generations that exceeds our lifetime. You know, so the pace needs to be kept at the forefront and a greater conversation needs to be instigated. You know, the conversation is about the majority and the minority. And when you're in power, I don't know who in human history ever relinquished power willingly. It needs to be taken. And that's where we are right now. I don't want to jump down the rabbit hole, but that's where we are right now. The majority are having their power and authority threatened, and they really don't know how to react to it. Sorry. I'll change the subject.
I'd actually like to go. Sorry, go ahead, Phil. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, you make a good point, because when Jackie Robinson came into the National League, I'm sure there were people who felt the same way, that they're going to lose their job if they start to bring in some of these black baseball players, because they had been playing against these guys. They knew the quality of play that was out there, and they knew if Jackie Robinson made good, that there were going to be others to follow. And so baseball history was going to be changed forever. And it could have been some people who were really threatened by him being on the field that day.
Sure. And, you know, once Leo DeLip returned from suspension, he essentially told the players as much. Sam, you brought up the petition, and Leo had to put them in their place. He was like, there's going to be a lot more behind Jackie Robinson. You better get used to it. And damn, yes, some of you are going to lose your jobs. So if anyone put it plainly, that in a manner that needed to be said, it was Leo. Everyone else was trying to be careful and delicate about it, or just outright deceitful. Leo made it very plain. say, you guys better recognize, because this is only the beginning. Change is coming your way. And people who are quick to recognize that and adapt, well, they fared better. People who resisted did not, you know, as simple as that.
Let's mention one of those players. Sorry, Phil. I was going to say, let's mention one of those players, Dixie Walker, the People's Church, you know, very quickly afterwards. It's interesting, you know, he did, I was watching some of the World Series of 1947, and, you know, Dixie Walker did get a couple hits, and he was still there, so he survived the whole year playing with that team. But Phil, you know, Dixie Walker, I don't think, you know, for one thing, his legacy was tarnished forever, and I don't think he lasted much longer in the majors.
Well, you know, what's interesting, we know about Dixie Walker's story. Now, I had the pleasure of interviewing Roy Partlow, who was with Jackie Robinson the year before at Montreal, and Clay Hopper was the manager that year. And according to Partlow, Partlow told me that Hopper never talked to him. He said Partlow said that he would go to Jackie Robinson, and he said, tell Partlow he's pitching today. And then Jackie would have to tell Partlow he was pitching. But you don't ever hear anything about the experience that Partlow faced when he was at Montreal is Jackie Robinson's teammate for a brief period. And, of course, Partlow never made it to the major leagues, and for all practical purposes, he's been a forgotten man.
Mike.
I can't add much to that. You're absolutely right, Phil. I mean, there's a narrative out there. We're only clued into maybe 20% of the full story that needs to be told.
Yeah, I would go with that, and I would probably think today when they talk about Jackie Robinson, there won't be many stories about, say, maybe Jose Acosta, a Cuban who came up, and as far as anybody knows, he didn't have any Negro blood in him or whatever, but yet he got called the same names that black players got called. And no one on the team would room with him because they felt that, you know, he might be part black, even though he's on the big league team. Actually, he was at Milwaukee in the American Association. Let me correct that. But no one would room with him. And so these are just some stories that probably need to be talked about today that probably won't be. And we'll get the same old refrain pretty much that we always get. But the story is more broad and deeper than we tend to hear it. And so it's good to talk about it again, and especially in these times when race relations are not at their best, that we need to know these stories so that we can make some changes and make some improvements and go and have a different, say, a different history moving forward. How about that?
How about that? You know, and I think this is an this is an appropriate time, Sam, to thank you, Phil, for all the work you do, because as you alluded to, the education needs to come from different places other than we're used to getting it from. You know, the schools aren't going to teach us this, not yet at least. So people like yourself and the historians of the like, I thank you, and I appreciate all the work you do.
Well, thank you. And like I said, I've had the pleasure to, you know, meet many people. Like I say, even talking to Roy Partlow. Roy Partlow didn't talk to a lot of people, and of course, he died back in 1987. And I just happened to be around long enough to even interview people like Sammy Haynes, who was a teammate with Jackie Robinson when he was at the Kansas City Monarchs in 1945, and different players like that. Hilton Smith. Had a chance to interview Hilton Smith, and I'm at the age now where I think I respect all of those interviews that I got when I was in my 20s more than ever, because I really feel like I was blessed to fall upon that information. But it's still so many things I want to share, and I'm just, you know, praying that I get to continue sharing for as long as I can and maybe make a difference somewhere down the line.
Well, Phil, once more, you have been a remarkable blessing to this podcast, and the information pouring through because of you is just, I'm so grateful and thankful to be able to bite your ear off. So
okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And so let's go to that. We're talking about modern times, you know, Jackie's legacy, but the race relations right now are not, you know, we still see many of the same things. Like you said, Mike, history repeats itself. When we were talking about it, it kind of reminded me of sports radio, at least in the New York region, and Mike and I can attest to this, that it's still rather white. And Phil, I'm curious, you know, with you being almost right smack in the middle of the country, do you think this is, you know, we're talking about one of the more progressive cities in the nation, and yet the sports radio, and I'm not taking away from the job a lot of these guys do. I think they're really good at their jobs. But there have been many, many vacancies over the years, especially recently, and we keep seeing white faces, and, you know, in terms of recently, somebody who unfortunately had to leave the morning came back, and he's rehabilitated after some issues, but you know, it's just yet another white face getting the airwaves, if you will. So what do you think about, I mean, it just seems like obviously it's a metaphor for all of society and all of culture, but the fact is that it's not just baseball that this is still a problem, it's all of sports as well.
Yeah, you bring about something that I experienced. I don't know if you know this. I used to be the assistant director of public relations for the Kansas City Royals. And in 89, 90, right through there, I was the person who put the Royals caravan together. And, of course, the Royals had this vast radio network out here in the Midwest. And so in the wintertime, we would go back and we would specifically go back to the radio stations that were carrying the broadcast. And I began to notice something about those radio stations and how it affected the fans. And here's what I noticed. Most of the Royals' radio baseball games were carried on country western stations. And so, or maybe, I would say mostly country western stations in the Midwest. And so when we would go to a city like Wichita, they would advertise that we're coming in the winter on the country western station. Of course, very few black people were listening to the country western station when the baseball game wasn't on. So we would go into a town like Wichita or, you know, Springfield, Joplin, different parts of Missouri, and there would be no black fans there because they didn't know that the team was coming. That's when I first realized that the station that the games are being broadcast on makes a difference. And I had never noticed that before until I experienced it. And you pretty much have the same thing now when you look around the country and you see which stations carry the games. That is a small subtlety that is not being discussed whatsoever.
Mike, I'll pass it over to you.
Well, you brought up sports radio here locally. We're listening to the same shows. And I could take this back to the 80s. My two all-time favorite sports radio personalities are Mr. Art Russ Jr. and Mr. Bill Daughtry. And, Sam, you're right. The industry is still dominated. And sports talk here locally is still dominated by white voices. And I say Mr. Art Russ Jr. because he was first. First for me here in the city back in the 80s before sports radio was a thing. And he made the biggest impression on me. And Mr. Bill Daughtry, just an incredible, incredible person, and he had me on the on his show once. I called into his show regularly when he was on the radio, and he had me up on the show once, and I just have nothing but thanks and appreciation for him. Both gentlemen are African-Americans, and I really can't name a third. And I'm not trying to fabricate anything here. It's just the way it is. Art Russ Jr. and Bill Daughtry are my one and two, and I don't have a number three.
Yeah. And you know, I didn't get a chance to hear Art Russ, you know, out here in the Midwest. But one thing I knew when I worked with the Kansas City Royals, I remember only one black, you know, everyday broadcaster, you know, that was broadcasting, you know, the team. And if I'm correct, I don't remember his name, but he was with the Cleveland Indians. But I do remember at the same time the Chicago White Sox were the first team to have a Spanish broadcast in the American League. And so I thought those were unique. And these were going on in 1989, 87, 88, right through there. So, but right. Still a lot of room for growth. And
sure.
And, you know, even when I worked for the Royals, I was the third black person to ever work in the Kansas City Royals front office. And they were considered the best organization in Major League Baseball.
And I would reiterate the pace of change. It's the pace of change that I find very frustrating. I won't speak for anybody else. I'll just say that's what I find most frustrating, the pace.
I'm not sure if you guys had any dead silence for me, but I am back. Unfortunately, I had to be in transit during this podcast, but that's what live show, that's what comes with a live show.
Okay.
So I'm trying to think of where I wanted to go next. I remember exactly. Mike, you were talking about those are the only two names that you can think of, and I feel like the other names, generally speaking, that get into sports broadcasting are former athletes. Retired athletes like Carl Banks or Bart Scott, for instance, and that is a problem. Phil, if you want to pick up on that.
No, that is generally it. It seems like a lot of athletes get in there, but it's kind of interesting, and I know in our particular city, over the years. Frank White was in there for a while, and then they pulled Frank White and gave it to somebody else, and a lot of people were upset about that. So, let me say one other thing too. Over the years, I made different friends with people who worked in Major League Baseball, and I know that there have been some racial lawsuits that were settled out of court. So no one's ever able to talk about them. So there is some things that went on in baseball that have not ever been discussed because they're not known to the public, and the people can't discuss them. So we're in some interesting times, but I think that if baseball is to continue growing and becoming, a world sport, I think once again we need to have the people who are in those markets that you want to enter in all phases of the game, from the booth to the field to the front office. We need to have people in all those areas.
Phil, allow me to ask you this question. Magic Johnson with the Los Angeles Dodgers, and now you have LeBron James associated with the Boston Red Sox. The entrepreneurship, where are the entrepreneurs? Because in most, aspects of life, we tend to say it starts at the top. So where are the entrepreneurial leaders who are going to, make these appointments without having to have this conversation?
Wow. Well, you know, once again, another interesting question. You know, for years, I asked many ball players this, because you come up, you play in a minor league system, you've been playing high school, you play in, then you've been playing baseball practically all your life, and then when you retire, you open up a restaurant, something you have never done before. And I used to always ask guys, I said, you know, you ever thought about purchasing a minor league team? Because they were always popping up. Miles Wolf is a person I know, and there was lots of opportunities for ball players to purchase minor league teams and begin to make some of these changes themselves. But even that wasn't touched on. And you do have some guys that are trying to make a difference on the major league level. But once again, I still think there's some opportunities at other levels that need to be sought out after as well. So ownership, there's lots of room for ownership at all levels in baseball. And I'd like to see that happen more. And I think in the 90s, there was I remember one lady, her father purchased a minor league team, and this was a black lady. But for the most part, there has not been a lot of black owners, even of minor league teams.
And it's just reminding me, Jordan still owns the Hornets, correct?
I'm not sure whether he does or doesn't. I should have included him as well.
Well, I was just curious because, I mean, I'm even, like, I do remember that they were able to get the name back, but I don't think they've done much since they got their name back. But I know that he owned the Bobcats, and I think it's still the same franchise, technically, renamed. But anyway, we digress. What I'd like to go back to specifically is the 1947 Brooklyn Dodgers and a team that Jackie Robinson, Rookie of the Year, was able to help bring to the World Series. So, we talked about, let's start back at that day where he wasn't able to take the showers on April 15th, 1947, Phil. So what are some of the things that you know in context of Jackie Robinson about the 1947 Brooklyn Dodgers?
Well, if you go back to the showers, and I got that information from players, and then the other thing was he couldn't room in the same hotel, so he pretty much stayed at boarding houses in the black community, and so he couldn't room at the hotel, which means he probably didn't eat with the team. But at game time, you were expected to be out there like you were part of the team. But the rest of the time, you kind of wonder how much were you a part of the team. And that's Jackie Robinson, who was probably getting the best treatment that some of these players would ever get. I think he probably got a better treatment than Larry Doby did when he first came up. So, a lot of racism that was off the field that I think probably there are more lessons to be learned about what went on off the field than what went on the field. Of course, everybody knows Jackie Robinson, of course, became Rookie of the Year. But can you imagine how much better he might have hit if he didn't have all the pressure that you put on a ball player, if he could just go out there and play and not have the stress of knowing, you feel like a member of the team. Who knows, man? He might have hit 400 in his rookie season. Who knows?
It's true, Mike. You never know how that stuff would go.
Well, I think having to relearn an entire league after just 1 year at Montreal, the way he did it, was outstanding. He won a batting title in 1949 after two seasons of having to literally learn an entire league's pitching habits. I think that's remarkable. And after that, he hit over 300 in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6 consecutive seasons. And let's not forget his age range. You know, he wasn't a rookie here with the Dodgers until he was age 28. So you can imagine, or one can imagine, had he started his career with the Dodgers or in Major League Baseball as a younger man and adjusted to the league and adjusted to the league, say, by age 24 or 25, what he might have been capable of accomplishing in his prime years. But, you know, in 1949 at age 30, yeah, he hit 16 home runs and drove in a career-high 124 RBIs. And that's after two seasons. But like I say, had he come into Major League Baseball as a younger man, into his prime seasons, I can only imagine what he might have accomplished. I think he might have even blown away the numbers that he posted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's,
so the fact that the fact that he won a batting title in his third season, to me, is pretty damn remarkable, considering all the homework, you know, quote unquote, that he had to do learning an entire league's pitching staff.
Wow. You know, I might mention, too, don't forget about six World Series he was in, too. And, you know, some guys are happy to get to the World Series one time. He's in the World Series six times before he retires. Last time, 1956. First time, 1947. That's quite an accomplishment. So I guess as we're talking, we can't forget about how good a player he was, how his excellence on the field, as well as how he handled things off the field, you know, as well. So, yeah, and of course, the first black player to get into the Hall of Fame, 1962. So,
I don't think I knew that information either. It almost is as if Jackie Robinson doesn't get enough credit for being the leader, like basically being the spark plug of the Dodgers dynasty. Because as Mike can attest, you know, understanding enough about Brooklyn as well as the history and relationship the Dodgers had with Brooklyn, you know, that was the peak, that was the pinnacle of the Dodgers franchise history. And then they were just ripped out from underneath the fan base's heart. But it's, you know, we talk about how there needs to be more done, but when you really think about it and you frame it that way you did, Phil, and I'll go to you, Mike, on this next, but the way you frame that about the fact that they went to six World Series, I mean, that was easily the most successful period in Brooklyn baseball history up until that point.
No question in my mind. No question in my mind.
Mike.
Yeah, that was a great period for Brooklyn baseball. Wow.
Without a doubt.
Mike, if you want to expand on it from a Brooklyn standpoint.
Well, definitely their most successful span in their Brooklyn history. And Jackie Robinson was the spearhead of that effort. Yeah, they were a great team. They had Duke Snider, Gil Hodges, Roy Campanella, Carl Furillo. That was a great assemblage of talent. But Jackie was definitely at the forefront of that. And insofar as leaders, yeah, he was the leader. When you look at his comportment versus adversity, that's a model for everyone in that clubhouse. Because nobody else had to go what he went through. So there's no way that he, just being Jackie Robinson, didn't impact his teammates. So I would call him the leader. Perhaps that was a clubhouse that didn't need a leader. You know, when you have an assemblage of like minds on the field, you know, you don't necessarily need a leader if you're all of the like mind. But, you know, in this collection of players, no one went through what Jackie went through. And his comportment was a model even to many a white player. So I think that speaks large.
Phil, I think I'm wondering, considering you said that he came up as a shortstop with the Kansas City Monarchs, but he was at first base in that first season. Now, he, you could say he went into the Hall of Famer as a second baseman. Do you think that he had to endure more potential violence at first base, considering he was the first person, whether you were safe or out, the opposition was seeing on an assist play?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, now I'm going back to my old baseball playing days myself. I think he received more punishment as a batter, and because pitchers could throw at you, and so they could throw at you back then, and you had no covering. And I remember talking to Joe Black, and he said that they began to throw at black players a whole lot less when they started to get more black pitchers up there, because they were going to start throwing at your guys just like you were throwing at, you know, the black player. So him up there by himself in that first season, I have to take a look at it, but I'm sure he got hit a few times as well.
You know, that's very interesting, Mike, just to think, like, where are you going to take punishment more, being the quote-unquote first black player in Major League history, at the plate or at first base?
I think Phil is correct. I think Phil is correct. He faced more and received more punishment in the batter's box, because when Jackie was on the bases, he wore spikes as well. So there was opportunity to, you know, get one in every now and then. Not so much in the batter's box. So that seemed to smooth itself out eventually.
Yeah.
There came a point where Branch Rickey said, all right, you know what? You do what you got to do, Jackie. And, you know, Jackie made his position quite clear. And very clearly, don't mess with me, man. Let's just play baseball. And I think a lot of people fell in line.
Yeah, and I just went and pulled up some data. In 1947, Jackie Robinson led the league in hit by pitch, which with seven, he had nine in 1947. So I'm wondering who led the league that year. But yeah, he actually led the league, and he had nine in 47. He had 14, got hit by 14 pitches in 1952. So, and he got hit by a pitch 72 times in his 10-year career.
Now, how would you like to have been that shortstop or second baseman with Jackie Robinson barreling down the baseline? You know, you have to take that into consideration as well. Like I say, he wore cleats as well, and those spikes are just as sharp. So, yeah.
So,
I
Phil,
think,
let me ask you this.
Okay.
Sorry I keep interrupting you, Mike. But, Phil, let me ask you that. This in that context. When did the league and the public know Jackie Robinson has arrived? When do you think the moment in the Major League season was, really, where everybody was like, oh, this is Jackie Robinson?
I don't know if there was a specific day, but he came out of the minor leagues when he was at Montreal, and he did so well at Montreal. And, of course, they want to say, well, that's the minor leagues. But, you know, he batted, what, almost 350 at Montreal. I think it was 349, something like that, led the league. And he had quite a few at-bats, like 400 at-bats. But when he came to Brooklyn, he had 590 at-bats that same year, still managed to hit 297. So he's right at 300. You know, you give or take, you know, a week, you have a good week, he's a 300 hitter, right? So, you know, as far as the Dodgers as an organization were concerned, oh, he had arrived the day he arrived in Brooklyn. They knew he was going to be a good ball player. They just had to figure out where they're going to play him and make the adjustments. But, you know, some of the fans were slow to catch. If you had a guy now that had 155 games, 444 at-bats, and batted 349 for the Yankees, would you think he's going to make a good big league ball player?
I would. Also,
I would.
I would also have. I would also have to throw this out there. You have to think of what was happening at the time. Jackie came aboard, but Gil Hodges was not yet on the team. He came up as a catcher and moved to first base because who was behind the plate and who was a better catcher? Roy Campanella. You know, so I think they all found the best place for themselves. Jackie at second, Gil at first, and Campy behind the plate. And let us not go ahead.
Good point.
No, I was gonna say that that's what's interesting, I guess, in some ways, of the 47 team is that it's kind of a hybrid of the pennant winner in 41 as well as what's to come. Keep up with the spot, Mike.
Well, let us not also forget that if it wasn't for Jackie, Roy Campanella wouldn't have been a Brooklyn Dodger. Because Roy thought, you know, Branch Rickey was full of it, that he was trying to sign him for his Negro League team, the Brown Dodgers, and Campy didn't want anything to do with that. He was happy where he was in Baltimore. And it just so happened that Effa Manley was putting together an all-star team to go to, I believe it was Venezuela. And Jackie and Campy were going to play on that team. And Jackie and Campy were unknowingly staying at the same hotel here in New York City. And when Campy got back to the hotel, Jack and he told Jackie about what had happened, Jackie said, no, you got it wrong. Call him back. And it was, I think once they landed in Venezuela, Campy got a hold of Branch Rickey, and explained to him his misunderstanding of the situation, because Branch Rickey wasn't clear about it. He was very vague about what he was alluding to. And it was while Campy was in Venezuela with the All-Star team that Branch Rickey and Campy finally reached an agreement. And as soon as he got off the plane back in America, he came racing to Brooklyn over to Montague Street, where you say that plaque is, and signed on with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But that one and a half, that wouldn't have had happened without Jackie informing Roy, hey, no, you misunderstood what's going on.
And I have another name for you. And he probably won't be mentioned today either, but a guy named Whitey Kurowski. He led the National League in hit by pitch. The only guy who got hit more times than Jackie Robinson in 1947. Whitey Kurowski for St. Louis. He got hit 10 times, and he beat Jackie, who got hit 9 times as a rookie. And so, his name won't be mentioned today, I'm sure.
Well,
I'm certainly going to have to do a little bit more research on that one. Now I'm kind of curious about that ballplayer. Let's see where to go next. We have just a little bit over 15 minutes left, so I'll ask you first, Phil. The black baseball fan in 1947. What was the environment like? How many black fans do you think the major leagues had outside of the Negro leagues? And what did Jackie Robinson's presence as well as other black ball players do for the basically white baseball at the time, Major League Baseball's demographic of fans?
Yeah, it's really interesting, the black fan and really black culture, because when Jackie Robinson goes over to the Brooklyn Dodgers, many black people become Brooklyn Dodgers fans. And some of those people would actually go to see the Brooklyn Dodgers and quit going to see Negro League teams play. And so within a few years, the Negro National League is out of business. What's also interesting is that the price that was paid for those players, you know, sometimes people ask me, I've never been a big Effa Manley fan, because I always felt like Effa Manley did a lot to bring the price of black players down. So when she was selling ball players for 8 you know, 8,000, 5,000, maybe 10,000 at the most. She was selling ball players that were worth 100,000. And that became the standard. So, you know, teams could say, you know, well, we got Larry Doby for 10,000, so we're not going to pay no more than 10,000 for this guy you got here. And so Kansas City, they couldn't get more. I think they got 7,500 or maybe 15,000 for Satchel Paige. But if you go back to, matter of fact, I'm looking at something I have here posted. There was a guy by the name of, his name was Bill Brinzel. Bill Brinzel. And the Pirates paid $50,000 for him in 1931. You don't even know who he is. You got to be like a serious baseball fan to even know who he was. Lefty Groves, when he was purchased by the Athletics, they played close to $100,000 for him in the 1930s, 1929, 1930, right in there. But they're picking up ball players for $10,000 that were worth millions. And so the Negro League goes out of business, and the black fans, they pretty much deserted in the major cities. And so teams, just to keep afloat, the Kansas City Monarchs, and who go on to 55, the Birmingham Black Barons and teams like that who managed to somehow survive, they survived not by playing major cities, but by playing small to mid-sized towns who weren't affected, and where people couldn't actually go and see a lot of ball players in the major league. So that's how they survived. But, yeah, it was like a wholesale raid, and the Negro Leaguers, you know, they didn't benefit. Now, the other thing is when they paid, like I remember talking to Jim LaMarck, and Jim LaMarck and those guys, they didn't want to be sold by Tom Baird, who was the owner of the Monarchs, because if he sold them for $5,000, he never gave them any money. So maybe they're making, you know, $300-$400 a month playing for the Monarchs, and then he sells their contract to the minor leagues. Then they go to the minor leagues. Now they're making $200 a month, and they never got any of the signing money. So it's once again, there's more to this story than that we talk about. But I often saw Effa Manley, who was the first to sell players, who pretty much set the standard for what it was going to cost to pick up a black player from a major league team or a Negro major league team.
Mike?
You see, I just received an education because I understood Effa Manley as the one who instigated teams be compensated for their talent when Major League Baseball came around seeking players. But the way you frame it, Phil, you know, it gives me different context. But Effa Manley at the same time was one of several owners who thought Larry Doby was going to be the first one to break the color barrier, not Jackie Robinson. But that's the way history turned out. And as we discussed, you know, Larry Doby did not have as good initial experience as per se Jackie might have. Larry Doby encountered a lot more adversity and controversy within his own locker room than Jackie did. But I just received an education on Effa Manley. I never heard it put quite in that context. I thought she was the one who stood up to Major League Baseball, instigating that if you want our talent, we must be compensated because, you know, they were coming in and effectively trying to steal talent away from them. So it's interesting. Interesting,
yeah,
to find out.
Yeah, and, you know, I've sat with this subject so long over the years that, you know, I tried to investigate it from every angle. And then the other thing, being a baseball fan myself, right, and you see, you know, these big numbers tossed around. I'll give you an example. The Cleveland Buckeyes sold, Sam Jethro to the Dodgers and for $5,000. And then a few years later, they sell Sam Jethro to the Boston team for $150,000. Tell me what was right about that and what was wrong about it. And those are the things I sit down and I try to evaluate what I think about them is relative to what I know about baseball history as a whole. So how do you buy a ball player for $5,000? So they knew that they were getting ball players at a discount, but, you know, it was just an interesting time because, once again, the black fan had deserted the game. And, you know, some of these owners, they were happy to get $5,000. But if they had stuck together, they could have changed the whole complexity of integration, probably made it a better experience for everyone.
And I also think those owners knew exactly what kinds of money they were exchanging. Because, hell, in the 1880s, 1890s, players were being purchased for tens of thousands of dollars. $10,000, $12,000. Mm-hmm. You know, and here we are discussing these figures 60 years later. So I think these owners knew exactly to say they were getting over insofar as the prices they were paying. Not much difference from 60 years ago, if not the same. So if anything, they were trying to keep those figures suppressed. And you might say they were a little successful in that endeavor. But, I brought up something that I wrote about the Atlantic City Bacharach Giants, because you asked about the atmosphere, the crowd, how that might have been. I'll take you back, 27 years back to the year 1920. And the New York Age, they were a prominent paper here in New York that covered Negro League baseball. And there was an author, he was an editor of, he was the sports editor of the New York Age, Ted Hooks. And he covered a game. But I'm just going to paraphrase something that he wrote about a game in 1920 to just give us an idea of what the atmosphere might have been like. And I'm jumping in the middle. Inside the stadium. Now, this is at Ebbets Field, coincidentally. This is the Bacharach Giants versus the New York Lincoln Giants in 1920. And he writes, inside the stadium, the press treated the games as social events as much as sporting contests. The New York Age gave several columns of their coverage to descriptions on the field, the team uniforms, the jazz band, the spectators, and the noise they made. Concluding, the game proved the colored fans the equal in deportment of any race that has ever graced Ebbets Field. Period. And I bring that up only to maybe just give us a small sense of the atmosphere that day of April 15th. Insofar as the African Americans in attendance, of course, this was going to be a predominantly white crowd, and I brought up a 1920s game between two Negro Leagues teams. So, yeah, the crowd is going to be different, but it's insofar as the atmosphere, maybe the frame of mind going to see Jackie Robinson that day, perhaps, you know, this that last line, the game proved the colored fans the equal in deportment of any race that has ever graced Ebbets Field. And that's a sentence that I will not forget ever since coming across it in researching that game in that era.
That's fascinating. I appreciate you sharing that with us. I want to bookend with, I'll start with you, Mike, with this. So we were talking about the legacy of Jackie Robinson in Brooklyn. So I will preface it with this, Mike, and I'll pass it right on to you afterwards. Instead of a plaque at 215 Montague Street, what about a statue of Jackie Robinson sliding into home plate?
That would be nice. That would be very nice. You have my vote. Here in Brooklyn, you know, New York City does a bad job of preserving all its history. It's not just baseball, all its history. It's an ever-evolving city, and, you know, it takes a lot for the city to really be on top of its history and cherish it, take care of it, and promote it. That being said, here in Brooklyn, you know, we still pay tributes to Jackie Robinson. There's a bunch of murals out there. There's one at a park I discovered on Sullivan Place. It's called Dodgers Playground, and there's a mural of him on the side of a building. There's one at Bedford Avenue at Rite Aid, right across from the Ebbets Field Apartments. Thank you, Dwayne Reed, for commissioning those murals. There's also a mural here at the post office on Flatbush Avenue over by or close to Marine Park. But around town, you know, we have the Jackie Robinson School on McKeever Place. There was an original mural. It has since been redone, and it's beautiful. As you mentioned, the plaque at Montague Street, that's where the Brooklyn Dodgers has had their executive offices, and that's the location where Jackie Robinson signed. And the statue, as we noted before, at MCU Park with the Brooklyn Cyclones playing Coney Island, the statue of Jackie Robinson and Pee Wee Reese. But no, Jackie Robinson needs his own statue commemorating just him. We have the giant number 42 at Citi Field. Here in Brooklyn, we have two New York City playgrounds that are named after Jackie Robinson, which I'm not so sure a lot of people are aware of. What else? We have the Jackie Robinson Parkway. You know, so here in Brooklyn, his name remains at the forefront. Just like Gil Hodges. We have a bridge, we have a street, we had a bowling alley. Carl Erskine, he has his own street here in Brooklyn. But there's a lot more going on dedicated to Jackie Robinson than any other Brooklyn Dodger. And of course, I failed to mention the commemorative home plate at the former Ebbets Field that commemorates this game that we speak of on April 15th, 1947. That was placed there, not quite sure, maybe 8 years ago, something to that effect, but there's that as well. So Jackie Robinson's name is sprinkled around Brooklyn still, and he remains in our conversations.
For anybody listening live, it's possible that it will cut out at 90 minutes, but by all means, please go to our archives, wherever you listen to podcasts, and we're probably going to bleed over. So, Phil, I want you to pick up from where he left off. I know I've asked you this a bunch of times, but have you been to Brooklyn, and have you been able to go out to where Ebbets Field used to be?
No, I have not been to Brooklyn. Been to Pasadena, where his house no longer stands. They tore it down in the 70s, believe it or not. They still didn't see Jackie Robinson's childhood home as being worth preserving, even up until the 1970s. So I have not been to Brooklyn, and I hope one day to come. Actually, I take that back. I was in Brooklyn, believe it or not, in 1992. I did an all-night radio show there. I think that was the last time I've actually been to Brooklyn, but I'm looking forward to coming soon as this pandemic is over. Maybe we can do some things when I get out there. And, you know, Jackie Robinson holds a special place in my life because, as a young child in the fifth grade, the first baseball movie I ever saw was outdoors on a playground, and it was the Jackie Robinson story, and they bought it in, as a summertime activity to be a diversion for young people to keep them out of trouble. And that was the night I saw the Jackie Robinson story. It wasn't on TV. So, you know, he holds a special place in my life because at that time I'm just getting started with learning baseball. And, you know, I was a fifth grader then. And was that about 5 decades ago? I'm still here talking about baseball. So it's been a great run, but it started with Jackie amongst other things.
Oh, I really appreciate you sharing that element of it. You know, it's not just the overall legacy of him. It is very personal for you, Phil.
Indeed, indeed.
Mike, you had something else to mention regarding Brooklyn and Jackie.
Phil mentioned Jackie's house in Pasadena, and I forgot to mention Jackie Robinson's house, Jackie Robinson's house here in Brooklyn on Cortelia Road. I think it's East 35th, and out front there's a plaque in front of the house. Whoever owns it today, but a plaque commemorating, you know, Jackie Robinson lived here.
Wow.
And I've never biked by that. So, you know, I'm certainly big into biking Brooklyn, Mike, so I'll have to loop back around to that. We'll bring it to the wrapping up portion of our show. But first of all, I want to thank Mr. Phil Dixon, Negro League historian extraordinaire, for joining us today and helping to basically put a little breathe air into this story, expand on this. And there's always so much different places, like you've said, Phil. There's always something else to uncover about the story. And I also appreciate that you talk about the way that we have many different broadcasts today talking about the Jackie Robinson story and talking about this day in baseball history. And they do it, and of course they should do it as positively as possible, but sometimes they do, they need, like you said, but we all feel as if the full story needs to be told, whether or not it's positive.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's an American story, but if you don't tell it from the full context of what was going on in America, what led up to the event, what happened, you know, shortly thereafter, and the legacy of Jackie Robinson, and hit on the pro and the con, I think you just missed too much, but it just helps you to understand how great an achievement of Jackie Robinson crossing the color barrier was and how it affected many things and how some of those things still need to be changed today. So there's still work to be done. And I'm sure if Jackie Robinson was here today, he'd be working on some of these things as well.
Well said. Thank you. The Brooklyn Trolley blogger, Mike Lacolon, thank you for joining us today. And like we just said, you know, It's a time to speak about the entire story and make sure it's positive to talk about the negative things.
Absolutely. There is no positive without negative. There's no negative without positive. You need one to compare the other by. So the whole story needs to be told. And one of my greatest thrills in life was meeting Sharon Robinson when they dedicated the Ebbetsfield flagpole over here at Barclay Center. She was there, and, you know, I knew what was going on. I didn't know she was going to be there, but I showed up to take my pictures, and there she was, and I struck up a little conversation, and I was thrilled, and I told her how appreciative I was of all her father's efforts, and, you know, we spoke, and there's still lots to be done. I'm sure, you know, Jackie Robinson was a strong-headed individual. He spoke his mind. He was opinionated. And, you know, I'm not so sure he'd be very happy right now. I think he'd have a lot to say.
That's a great point. I want to give you an opportunity, as we like to call it on here, shameless plug, Mike. Go ahead.
Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. It's just a spin on the Brooklyn Trolley Dodgers. That's the way it started. But it's just where I hang out and root for all the New York City sports teams. My favorite teams and all of them. You know, I give everyone equal share. But I have my favorites in my life in Brooklyn. That's where I celebrate my life in Brooklyn. I love this place. And I love the history, and I love the sports involved in it. And I just put it all into one site, you know. So that's it. You know, I'm not a big promoter. Brooklyn Trolley Blogger.
Thanks as always, Mike. And Mr. Phil Dixon, by all means, shameless plug away. Tell everybody where they can reach you.
Yeah. Well, they can reach me by going to my website, which is NLB, like Negro League Baseball, so it's NLBAlive.com. You go over there, and you can go into the gift shop and purchase my latest book. And if you purchase them there from there versus getting them on Amazon, I can sign them for you since we're not out doing many live appearances, but I can certainly sign them for you or anyone you like. And of course, my Twitter page, if you go to Twitter, at Negro League Man, I try to keep you engaged as I can with Negro League facts, and I'm sure I'll post something on Jackie Robinson today. I don't know. I may mention the name Dick Littlefield. I don't know if you know that name. They won't mention that one today, but that's who the Giants traded for Jackie Robinson in 1956. And who is Dick Littlefield? That's what we want to know. We know who Jackie Robinson is, but Dick Littlefield and $35,000. So anyway, it's been great talking about it. And actually, I like to write about it, too. So I enjoy this topic and still working on new projects.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with all those new projects. And we want to, we urge everybody out there to go to NLBAlive.com as well. As wherever, you know, you can pick up his books. You got so many different books on so many aspects of Negro League baseball. It's just really a blessing, Phil. So thank you again for doing all that you do. And I also want to thank, of course, the audience. Thank you all for listening today. Keep the Jackie Robinson story alive. Make sure that it's we're expanding on it, and you know, stay dry out there for everybody in the tri-state. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Phil, and thanks to everybody out there. We'll catch you next time. Take care.
Well, thank you.